Jazz organist Jimmy Smith with Midnight Special, featuring Stanley Turrentine on sax, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Donald Bailey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Friday, June the 14th, and we'll be talking about President Obama's decision to arm rebels seeking to topple Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. We'll be talking about Israel's decision to deport some 60,000 Africans, most of them from repressive regimes, to undisclosed countries. But first, a three-pronged legal attack against the government's expansive and unchecked powers of covert surveillance of citizens. Patrick Toomey is a legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, which filed a lawsuit against the National Security Agency on Tuesday. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's great to be on your program.
Thank you. I'm delighted that you're here. So the lawsuit, as I understand it, of course, it grew out of the documents leaked by Edward Snowden, but not exclusively so, because the ACLU had its own ongoing issues over privacy. Could you tell us about the three prongs of the legal attack?
Of course. The ACLU has been litigating issues around government surveillance for some time now, in the aftermath of September 11th and the Patriot Act. And as recently as this past February, we had the Supreme Court reject one lawsuit that alleged a wiretapping program very similar to the one that we've seen. But the court determined that at that point in time, the ACLU did not have standing to bring the lawsuit. With the revelations this past week, it now seems clear that the government is engaged in widespread surveillance of both American phone calls and the metadata associated with those calls, and a very expansive interpretation of its targeting of foreign communications.
Well, what is the interpretation of the law that you're seeking clarity on?
So we filed a motion with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court this past Monday, and that's one of the three prongs that I think you're alluding to. And the motion that we filed with the Secret FISC Court is a motion requesting access to secret legal opinions that have been issued by that court and that interpret the scope of the laws at issue, the laws that allow the government allegedly to collect records relating to every phone call that Americans make, including the call by which I'm participating in this very interview. I'm on a Verizon phone. And the opinions of the Secret FISC Court have been held back from the public, and the ACLU believes that the public is entitled to know how that court has interpreted both the statute that's part of the Patriot Act and also the Fourth Amendment, our Fourth Amendment rights that are clearly implicated by this invasion of privacy.
Well, I hate to ask this question. It may sound a little funny, but where does one find the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court?
It's actually a very
the
hard
secret
court to find.
Where do you find it? Where is it?
As we discovered this week, trying to file our motion with it, It is headquartered in Washington, D.C., but has no known official address. And in fact, in order to file our motion with the court, we had to submit the motion through the Department of Justice, which then transmitted the motion to the court. The judges on the court do serve in other capacities on the federal district court. So they are publicly identified officials, but you can't file your motion with them in their capacity as federal district court judges. You have to go through the Department of Justice.
That's kind of convoluted, but that raises a very serious question about the constitutionality of the court itself, does it not?
The ACLU hasn't challenged the constitutionality of the court, although we do have serious reservations about the way that it functions and the way that the secrecy in which it is shrouded keeps an adversarial process from really being part of the court's decision-making, because when you have the government requesting orders to wiretap or to gather phone records from Americans, the only party before this secret court is the government itself. Sometimes telecommunications companies can become involved if they want to object, but the people whose records are being gathered, like you and me, have no opportunity to appear before the court and to impress upon it the arguments in favor of protecting our privacy rights.
You know, many years ago, when I was doing a show on Channel 13 in New York, I asked, the guest was Raymond Kelly, police commissioner, and I asked about this court because certain requests that cities have to make, you know, when they're investigating secret stuff, have to file requests with this court. And I asked him about the existence of this court and the what kinds of requests had he made of this court, and I never did get an answer. He never answered the question. So this is a court that has been of interest to me for quite some time. But he didn't deny, of course, that he did for what I called then black bag jobs, you know, where people just sneak into places and wire them overnight and put surveillance equipment in places that they want to monitor. So this court essentially... Could the argument be made that the actual function of this court and this court's decisions granting or not granting permission to do certain things, the court is functioning outside the purview of checks and balances by, say, a Congress or the judicial system as it is?
We think that that's absolutely the case. The court, while it is set up under the as part of the judiciary, it doesn't function the way that most Americans assume our courts work. And so when government officials have repeatedly said over the past week that these programs were approved by all three branches and therefore must be legal, we think that they are really mischaracterizing the type of process that most Americans associate with government oversight, genuine government oversight, when they hear that phrase. Because one, as you said, the court itself is a secret court in which the American public is rarely, if ever, represented. And even Congress's oversight has been severely limited because of the secrecy, such that only a select handful of members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees actually have full access to the scope of these programs and the legal interpretations that support them. So we've heard a lot of members of Congress coming forward in the past week to voice concerns because and saying that they had no idea that the Patriot Act was being interpreted in this way and that the government was engaged in such a dragnet type of surveillance of our communications.
If all things should go your way, what would the result mean in terms of the specifics on which you base the lawsuit?
We have only challenged at this point in time the government's gathering of phone call metadata on all calls of the Verizon subsidiary, Verizon Business Network Services. But if a court found, as we hope it will, that the acquisition of those records en masse was unconstitutional or illegal under the Patriot Act, we think that it would have far-reaching consequences for that program and probably for others, because it would define the Fourth Amendment standard that applies to the collection of our electronic communications in a number of different areas.
Does the lawsuit anticipate that the response would be there are certain functions of government that really are outside of general purview because that's just the nature of things. When we have the country having to face certain things, certain threats, it has to respond in a particular way, and it is not so much on an infringement of the rights of citizens or the intention to infringe on the rights of citizens, but it is simply doing its job of safeguarding the country.
There has to be a balance between civil liberties and national security, and the ACLU believes that that balance needs to be struck, but it needs to be struck in a way that the public understands and that members of Congress and the executive branch and even the judiciary are not in a position to unilaterally resolve that debate and that balance. And we believe that the government can disclose the nature of its surveillance programs at a general level and the legal reasoning that rests behind them without disclosing very sensitive information about intelligence targets or methods that would endanger national security in the way that they seem to suggest. We think that the public can have much greater transparency in order to allow us to have a real debate about the extent to which we think the government should be collecting our everyday communications.
You filed a suit Tuesday. What do you expect the timeline would be for a response?
Generally, the government has 60 days to respond to the filing of a lawsuit like the one we filed on Tuesday. We don't know how quickly they will respond, but they could respond very quickly, or they may take advantage of that full time. But we think this case will move forward quickly in the grand scheme of things because there are the order on which it is based puts the program and the government's capture of these communications squarely at issue.
Did you expect that, I mean, you had to work really fast to put this lawsuit together, but did you expect that it would rest so heavily on Snowden's revelations?
We did. In fact, that was the impetus for the filing of the complaint at this time. Without those materials, without those disclosures to the public, we would not be in a position to identify a specific court order which allows the government to record records related to every phone call that Americans make, or every, at least in this case, every customer of this Verizon subsidiary.
But are you satisfied that the information that he has revealed is solid?
We believe that it is solid and that it reflects the truth. The government, in fact, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, essentially acknowledged the authenticity of the order on Friday when he declassified certain details about the program in response to the disclosures. So we believe that it does provide a solid foundation for this lawsuit.
Well, I want to thank you, and I wish you the best in this legal proceeding, because it is very disturbing that we do have this very secret court. It's been around for quite some time, and if at least it does the outing of this court, your suit would have achieved a great good for the public. So thank you very much, Patrick Toomey, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you. All right. Well, you know, this is how it works. Things happen, and they're not entirely disconnected from each other. Whether one, whatever the opinion one has about Ed Snowden, and I certainly have my opinions about it, it's this discussion about what are the rights of citizens as opposed to the rights of government. If, in fact, we live in a democratic society, what are the checks and balances that maintain things so that they're kind of fair and that people have a sense that they're not victims of the government, but they are, you know, living in a society where their rights are not unilaterally usurped. We go now to a subject that is quite disturbing, and that is that the government of Israel has decided that it will deport around 60,000 African refugees. The state calls them infiltrators, most of them from Eritrea and Sudan, but others from other parts of Africa, to undisclosed countries. And for this part of the conversation, we're joined by Mark Levine. Mark is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine, and a distinguished visiting professor at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Lund University in Sweden. He's also the author of a forthcoming book about the revolutions in the Arab world. Thanks so much, Mark, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, what's going on, as you've been able to ascertain about this program?
Well, I mean, I think the two main issues is the fact that, you know, Israel is using the idea, this idea of an infiltrator's law, to brand, you know, people who could very easily be described as refugees or at worst economic migrants as somehow, you know, fundamental threats to the state, and then to detain them, you know, and certainly in very often in inhumane conditions. And then the second thing is the idea that you can take these migrants and send them somewhere else that no one will even know about, as if you can literally just disappear them into some kind of black hole and no one will have to worry about them again. These are both very troubling issues. And, you know, obviously in this scheme of what else is going on in the world this week, perhaps they're not getting that much attention, but it's clearly to me just another indication of how far Israel, it's not that it's moved from any kind of pretense of democracy, but how far it's presently situated in terms of any pretense of democracy or following, you know, international norms or law when it comes to dealing with migrants. I mean, and well, of course, as a historian, it's especially galling considering, you know, how Israel's founding is so tied into migrants from, you know, from Europe, especially after the Holocaust, who were prevented from coming to Israel and treated very inhumanely and put in camps. So it's repeating in many ways exactly the kind of behavior that its early citizens were subjected to as they tried to get to the country.
Well, the administration, Netanyahu's administration, is maintaining that it does not have to reveal which countries the infiltrators. It's a really interesting kind of label to place on someone who is a refugee as an infiltrator, that they're not compelled to reveal where they're sending them. But some opponents are saying it's because they don't quite know, and they're just trying to figure this out and give it a legal kind of mask to cover up the fact that this was just an arbitrary decision that has not yet been well thought out.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could just be that they're being sent back to Sudan, and since Sudan and Israel don't have any kind of formal relations because it's Sudan, is, you know, doesn't recognize Israel, it could be that they're being vague because they don't want to, you know, if it got out publicly that the two governments were dealing with each other in any way, it would discredit the Sudanese government. So it could ultimately be somewhat more benign than it could seem if you want to play it for the worst possibilities. But they're just, the reality is that even if Israel's trying to do the right thing, which would surprise me somewhat since it doesn't usually do that, as most governments don't, you can't, you know, there has to be transparency when dealing with these kinds of issues. The states, whether or not we agree that there should be completely open borders globally, that's a philosophical and political and ideological debate, but and people can choose whatever view they want. But there is an international system set in place for dealing with migrants and refugees, and you can't simply, just because it's not politically convenient for either government, the government that they're being sent to or returned to or sent from, you can't just put them in the black hole so that international agencies and the UN or whoever would deal with them can track them, because that just opens it up for just enormous abuse of these individuals who've already suffered so much. Another thing I would say that a problem with this is, of course, is the Sinai right now. I mean, one obvious route for these people from the Sudan and Eritrea to get to Israel is through the Sinai, and this and the troubles that are in the Sinai now with the, you know, essentially a rebellion and constant violence against the government is making it much harder for the travel to come through. So they're going, it's becoming much more difficult and much more clandestine, and we still don't exactly understand what Israel's role is in the rebellion in Sinai right now. So there's all kinds of issues that are being raised that we don't have the answer to, and not being completely transparent about it really makes, you know, puts these people in serious jeopardy.
Is it not surprising that and shocking that a matter of refugees has not yet gotten just worldwide outcry, based on the fact that as refugees you would imagine that Israel, being a signatory to international conventions on human rights and refugees, would want to do this in keeping with the international standards with respect to refugees?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, one of the problem is we don't necessarily know, you know, if these people are kept in camps, if they're not given the full ability to tell their stories, we don't know how many are legitimate refugees. There seems to be, according to reports from Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, clear indications that, you know, many, if not the majority of these people would fit the categorization of refugees under international law, and therefore Israel cannot deal with them in the way that it's dealing with it. This, of course, the Israeli government, knowing this, has every incentive to make sure their stories aren't told. But again, this is nothing new. I mean, nor is it unique to Israel. You could certainly look at the way the U.S. government has dealt with, you know, quote-unquote illegal migrants, and that is often equally a violation of international law, and there's very little outcry against that. I mean, most governments, you know, one of the things about this present global order that we're living in is that states have even less need to abide by the international architecture that was constructed in the last century, and you know, essentially just ignore them at their leisure without fear of much retaliation, because everyone else is doing the same thing. So I'm not surprised that there's not much outrage against, you know, Israel's actions, especially when you consider, let's say, what's happening in Syria, where there are tens of thousands of people being killed. It's hard for people to focus too much energy on these refugees. But from an Israeli perspective, if you're interested or concerned about Israel, it's a very important issue, because it lends, you know, you're talking about one of the most fundamental components of Israeli identity, which is as a haven for refugees. And the fact that it is willing to treat other refugees so callously, you know, is another indication of how fascistic it is, for lack of a better word, and I don't know a better word, the country has become in terms of its dealing with non-Jews. And that's obviously, we've already seen that with Palestinians over decades, but now it's applying it even, you know, as harshly to African migrants and others. It just is part of a larger paradigm shift within Israel towards really an incredibly xenophobic and exclusivist and even militantly exclusivist ideology towards any other, not just the main enemy, which is Palestinians.
Well, you anticipated a question I was going to ask. Since the last time we talked, you were heavily involved in the settlement issue and whether there was going to be any kind of a peace brokered between the Palestine and Israel with respect to land that needed to be ceded back to Palestine, to the Palestinians, and you were very much involved in that. So looking at the two, what do you see as a parallel here?
Well, I mean, there is no peace process. There's a peace business, but you know, the country is no closer to being divided now than it's ever been, which is to say that it's not going to happen. You know, it's hard to know, you know, why all this energy is still being put into following a two-state process, which was dead before it was, you know, which was essentially stillborn. But, you know, clearly, if you think about it, if you're the Obama administration, which is really the only force that could compel Israel to actually fulfill its international obligations and actually sign on to a two-state deal, it has no political power to do it. The one time early on in his first term when Obama tried to speak, you know, even meekly about the problem of the occupation, Netanyahu slapped him down hard. Vice President Biden was humiliated in a trip to Israel, and the Israelis realized they could do that without any fear of political repercussion. So there's no incentive for them to do this. And more Israelis are talking about, and I mean politicians and openly in conferences and covered by the media, are talking about, you know, just ending the farce and annexing the West Bank, and in fact even granting Palestinians in the West Bank citizenship. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that would probably be the best solution at this point, because at least they could struggle within the paradigm of citizenship as opposed to aliens without any rights. You know, the problem with this scenario is that it only works from an Israeli perspective if Gaza can be cut off from the West Bank, because as long as Gaza is cut off, Jews can maintain a numerical majority, albeit a smaller one, for several generations, even if they absorb the West Bank. If you have to absorb Gaza too into a fully binational state, then the majority is already over. So, you know, the real thing to be looking at in the next few years is how is it that Israel is going to attempt to manage severing formally Gaza and the West Bank. That's clearly been its strategy since the beginning of Oslo, which is what it did at the beginning of Oslo with the Gaza-Jericho plan. It's clearly happening now as Israel has allowed Qatar and Turkey and Egypt to play a much bigger role in the management of affairs in Gaza, investing in Gaza, ending the real harsh siege, allowing Gaza's infrastructure to develop. It's now in a mode where, you know, a developed Gaza that is being run by its Turkish and Qatari friends is certainly not a threat to it, and in fact a boon to it. And if that can be managed, one can see how it would be able to then officially at some point annex the West Bank and with it the Palestinian population. So that's the dynamic that I think is going to be happening in the next few years. And I don't see Palestinians having any power to stop it. So, I think the struggle is going to have to shift sooner rather than later from Palestinians to fighting for a fully democratic state and for making sure that Gaza isn't just left floating in the wind.
But this race-based policy, and it might also have religious overtones, because I suspect that many of the refugees are Muslim, it would therefore suggest that Israel, under Netanyahu, of course, whose father was very, very much identified with the Zionist movement, mm-hmm. that Israel is in effect affirming its Zionistic rights to basically establish a state simply
for
Jews.
Years. Of course,
it is.
I mean, it's always affirmed. It's a Zionist state, so it's always going to affirm its Zionistic rights. I mean, that's the basic definition of the state, is a Zionist Jewish state. So it's going to act and always act. And in fact, Likud and Labor, even dividing them into two different separate factions is a myth. It's completely inaccurate. Labor and the Likud are far closer, let's say, than Democrats and Republicans in terms of their fundamental ideological similarity. There really are and have almost always been good cop, bad cop in that regard. You can just see the career of Perez, the current president, as and how he behaved as prime minister in the past, and his cooperation with Shamir and other Likud leaders in the 80s, the role of the Labor Party in the restructuring of the Israeli economy. All this is, you know, bespeaks a fundamental similarity between Labor and Likud in all but rhetoric. So, and both are, you know, extremely militant ethno-religious nationalists. But that's what Zionism has always been. It's never shied from saying that. It's an ethno-religious national exclusivist movement trying to gain control and maintain control over a territory with as few other people there as possible that could threaten its demographic superiority. So there's no, you know, there's no surprise about any of this. The question really is, what do you do about it? You know, what do those who are struggling for real human rights? What I think is most interesting is that, you know, increasing number of Israeli Jewish friends and colleagues of mine who 6-7 years ago, even if they ideologically supported a democratic solution, a one state or binational state solution, felt it was not politically politically possible yet. Now that the Likud is openly talking about a one-state solution, they're able to come out of the closet, so to speak, and advocate for a democratic state. So in the end, I actually think these developments are, forget the refugees, that's a smaller issue, certainly important, but in terms of the larger politics, what's happening now is can be looked back on 10 years from now as a good watershed moment, because it's forcing all sides to stop talking about fantasy. You know, if it's clear that this is going to end up as a binational state. I've been working with some Palestinian and Israeli colleagues for the last 5 years on a project that we call a parallel state solution, which would allow for two states but with shared sovereignty, a new conception of citizenship that would remove the ties between individual and territory, so Jews and Palestinians could live throughout Israel-Palestine while maintaining their allegiance and their citizenship with their own state. That's one way to solve the problem of both settlements and returning Palestinians. There are certainly others. So the sooner we just begin to speak honestly, the sooner we can move to a place where both Palestinians and Jews can live with full human rights and dignity and democratic potential. That's, I think, the space we need to start talking about now. The less we even talk about two states, the better, because it's like talking about a heavily airbrushed photo in a fashion magazine that, and you see the real model and he or she looks 80 years older and nothing like the photo. You know, it's time to stop using the airbrush, look at the ugly reality, but realize inside that ugly reality is actually the kernel of a beautiful future if we can just talk about it. And it's absolutely moving in that direction. There's no way it can't move in this direction, because there's you know, this is the natural course of events. It's going to be a human rights and democracy struggle. It'll eventually play out. And, you know, in the end, we'll have basically a democratic country like South Africa, where in return for democracy, the Jews keep most of the money, just like whites did in South Africa. And then 20 years later, everyone will think, but why is it worse now than it was then? You know, this is unfortunately the way the world works under a neoliberal system, but that's the struggle we need to deal with.
Mark Levine, thank you so much for being with us today.
No, thank you for having me again.
Thanks a lot. We'll take this break, come back and talk about President Obama and arms to Syria. It would have been heartless of me to break up that lovely phrase there by Stanley Turrentine. You're listening to Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and just a kind of a semi-editorial here about President Obama's decision yesterday to authorize what is known as lethal aid to Syrian rebels seeking to drive Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, out of office, and just plain out if they can do it. And here is a very interesting way in which people are deceived. The role of government in deceiving, deliberately deceiving people. From that expression, you remember that President Obama had drawn the red line, he said, in the sand, as it were, over the allegations that Assad's regime had used nerve gas against its own citizens, and that the United States was withholding any further involvement in Syria until it could confirm that, in fact, that was true. And lo and behold, it has confirmed that it is true. And although not nearly as pervasive as the use of lethal gas was originally reported, they said, for example, the number at about 100 to 150 people of the 93,000 already killed in Syria during this war, the civil war, about 100 and 150 people, they said, might have been the victims of nerve gas. But it, in any event, confirmed the use of nerve gas by the regime. And therefore, the United States would respond, but not with direct involvement by putting soldiers to fight in the civil war, but that it would instead provide arms to the rebels fighting the Assad regime. The way it is presented, it is meant to indicate that this is a new initiative. This is a brand new decision. It came out of nowhere, you know, just basically the consequences of Syria's action, and the action being the nerve gas use. But I have to remind folks that we have an unanswered question, and it is called Benghazi. And the what was the purpose of the so-called diplomatic mission in Benghazi? It was not a diplomatic mission. And what was the purpose? And the purpose always had been that it was a transshipment point. And that was what it was there for. It was a CIA operation, a transshipment point for weapons going into Syria all along. So it was kind of bewildering to hear that there was this new decision by President Obama that he was going to authorize weapons for Syria. That was par for the course, and that had been going on. In fact, that is the question. The issue of Benghazi has not yet been resolved. It has not yet been answered definitively by this administration and by the previous Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. What was the purpose of Ambassador Stevens being in Benghazi at that place at that time? He was there. Intelligence sources say he was there to coordinate with the rebels, who, interestingly enough, include Al-Qaeda operatives, that the United States was actually sending arms into Syria for the rebels, quote-unquote, among whom are members of Al-Qaeda, the very people that this administration says it is interested in fighting. So you have to understand, I was a bit puzzled yesterday when this decision, this momentous decision came that the United States will be providing all these weapons. So now it's kind of like clear, and it is official. We're now officially sending arms to the rebels. But the unfinished business, and it should be addressed, I think. What was the quote, mission, unquote, in Benghazi all about? And is it true or is it not true that the United States has been engaged in fully arming these rebels all along? The CIA was there to conduct training, and these weapons were stashed there for shipment into Syria. We heard that. In fact, that was a question posed directly to Hillary Rodham Clinton, you would recall. The question came, I believe, from Rand Paul. Is it true, Secretary of State Clinton, that the compound that was raided on September the 11th, just last year, in which the ambassador and three others were murdered and killed in a long, protracted, intense battle in which they got no assistance. Is it true that that compound, which was not a diplomatic compound, and they keep referring to it as a consulate or a diplomatic compound, it was neither, it was just a rented house and an annex. Was that quote, compound, or those compounds, were those the buildings that coordinated in an underground kind of way with the so-called rebels in Libya and fed them the weapons? That was the, was it a transshipment point? And she said, really? I'd never heard that. I have to check into that and I'll get back to you. Well, somebody should sign a subpoena and ask Mrs. Clinton to return and refresh her memory. And for this administration to pose this issue for the people of the United States as if this is a brand new initiative, this is a brand new response, although it clearly has to explain whether or why it has been aiding and abetting the rebels all along, and whether, in fact, the raid on Benghazi was in response to the fact that the United States had been providing weapons to the rebels, and that is why the attack occurred. It is an unanswered question. But I believe that it ought to be asked, and I believe that this president ought to account for it, and I believe Hillary Rodham Clinton should be called back to Congress, and it ought to be explained. What was the use or what was the purpose of the so-called diplomatic compounds in Benghazi? Why was Ambassador Stevens there? Your calls at 888-874-4888. We have a few minutes. We could certainly take a call. But, you know, the reason that I'm raising this is that this is how people are conned. This is a very deceptive and dishonest thing for this administration to do. And it's typical, I hate to say, of the Obama administration. It has become the kind of thing that you would expect it to do. You know, you make it look like something that it's not. So we have to get some answers. It is not about this new decision to supply weapons. It's not new. And I think that we need to ask questions about that. This is not a new decision. The president is getting away with it because, of course, Bill Clinton had taken issue with the administration's, quote, official stance, unquote, that it was not going to get directly involved in the civil war in Syria. And then John McCain took a swing through and found himself in the company of very questionable people who themselves allegedly had ties to Al-Qaeda. And he came back saying the United States ought to get involved. So now that we have the hawks pushing the agenda, we've got to get involved. The administration doesn't have the guts to say, we've been involved. We've been involved all along. We've been supplying them with weapons all along. We've been supplying military training all along. And Benghazi was a CIA hub. We've been there. So now the United States will now take the official position, okay, we are now officially involved, but not really, really, really involved. We're just going to give some weapons. We put a couple of coins in the collection plate. Is this not the height of hypocrisy? So let's see if anybody in Congress raises the question. Hello, Orville, you're on the air.
Hello, Yitris. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to ask if what the possibility you just laid out, it's a possibility, and that's why they were questioning Ms. Clinton about that shipment, if it was a shipment place to Syria, then logically, if you're playing a game of chess, how then was Libya attained? Was there a larger game going on?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking at a domino effect, and then so how did you and why did you secure Libya? And then, you know, and then it just goes on, and you know, and I just wonder, what are we doing in terms of the populace, in terms of, you know, in just terms of thinking? And
well, you know, the one thing was when Hillary Clinton was asked this question, you know, it's lawyer to lawyer. Although, of course, we have Rand Paul as a senator, but he's a lawyer. And lawyers do something that is a force of habit. They don't ask questions that they don't already know the answer to.
Mm.
He knew the answer. He asked a question so that it would be on the books. It would be documented. The lie would be documented. That's why he asked a question.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got exactly the response that he thought he would get, which is, oh, really? I haven't heard that. I'll check into that, and I'll get back to you. Well, she hasn't gotten back to anybody yet. This is what people do, you know, in governments, as I said. All governments lie, every single one of them.
And it goes on in many other institutions, and it just seems to be a habit now. The society is ensconced in to such a deep level. Everybody is doing this, and then the whole thing is just going to hell in a handbasket. You know,
yeah,
the whole thing.
But they're pulling the wool over people's eyes, thinking that, you know, well, now this is a new initiative. This is brand new, has nothing to do. We have no history in this fight until now. And that is an absolute blatant lie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, the president comes forward and makes this claim that, yes, he has studied the, you know, he's now giving the rational answer. Assad's regime did use nerve gas. And, yes, we are appalled that 93,000, maybe more people already have been killed. And he has crossed the red line. And we are going to respond. We're not directly involved. We're not sending soldiers to die in Syria. But we will give them the weapons, those who are interested in fighting for a just cause.
Mm-hmm. Yitris, there's a trajectory, and it's good to hear you, and it's good to be for this show to exist, and I just want to say thank you.
Thank you so much for calling.
All right.
Thank you. Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of our program, or close to the end of the program, and I just wanted to put these things out there so that we keep tabs. You know, the government of Israel's treatment of the African refugees is nothing but absolutely appalling. And what they have done is, in order to not classify many of them as refugees, they have decided that they would tag them as people who are illegal in Israel looking for work, and therefore they call them infiltrators. So they've removed the refugee label, but everybody can tell that they are refugees. But they're doing this and holding them in really inhumane conditions. It should not be at all. And when you have 60,000 people in a state that is absolutely committed, I mean, there's no humanity here. And the historical irony of it, that a state founded on the premise that they're all refugees and they needed some place to go, that they would treat Africans like this, but that they are selective too, the selectively treating Africans this way. People ought to speak out about it. And Mark Levine tells us that the movement is within Israel as well. And, you know, the opposition in Israel and the human rights issues that are raised in Israel, they do not get very good coverage at all, or they get no coverage whatsoever. So you never get a feeling that there are Israelis who are absolutely appalled at these things. The media basically play its servile role of allowing the view to be that Israelis are unanimous in their thinking and in their actions about certain things, and they're not. Well, I hope this gave us some things to think about over the weekend, but don't let it just creep into your weekend. You know, take your time and rest a little bit, because, you know, this is the battle will be there on Monday morning. But in the meantime, I want to thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Please do tell people about PRN.FM and certainly about this program as your choice for information. Take care. Bye-bye. ¶¶